the Antiwhite system and tune in to the Pro-White system at RadioArian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, May 31st, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioArian.com. And today is the fourth episode in our series on lost white civilizations. And today we're going to be talking about ancient Egypt, which, of course, if you look at the country now, it's just filled with brown Arabs. But originally it was white. And we're going to be using March of the Titans as our source material for this. And I'll probably be adding some of my own comments to it as well. And this is from Chapter 8, Nordic Desert Empire, Ancient Egypt. Although situated in North Africa, Egypt had been settled by three white groups prior to 3500 BC, namely Old European Mediterranean types, Proto-Nordics, and Nordic Indo-Europeans, with the latter group penetrating the territory as part of the great wave of Indo-European invasions which took place from 5600 BC onwards. Living in typical Neolithic settlements, this period of history is called the pre-dynastic period and is formally considered to have come to an end in 3100 BC. And I'll just point out that when he talks about Indo-European invasions, and he talks about them coming from the north, he doesn't mean they're coming from the north as in Scandinavia. He means they are coming from the north as in the Caucasus Mountains, which is at the tip of what is now Turkey. So it's really not very far to come down from the Caucasus Mountains to the Fertile Crescent, which is Syria, Iraq. It's not far from Armenia to that Fertile Crescent. And of course, that's where these Indo-Europeans originated from. That's why we have the term Caucasian, meaning white man. And coincidentally, it's also where the white man originated according to the Bible. Because according to the Bible, we all come from Shem, Ham, and Japhet, the three sons of Noah. And Noah's Ark apparently came to rest in the Caucasus Mountains. And then they came down from there. So, interestingly, the biblical narrative fits in with the general narrative that these Indo-Europeans came from the Caucasus into the Fertile Crescent and into Europe and into India and elsewhere. Anyway, continuing with the Nordic Desert Empire, Ancient Egypt. Racially speaking, the inhabitants of Egypt at this period in time, that's before 3100 BC, were divided into three groups. Skeletal evidence from grave sites shows that the original white Mediterraneans and Proto-Nordics were a majority in that area. A well-preserved body found in a sand grave in Egypt, dating from approximately 3300 BC, on display in the British Museum in London, was nicknamed Ginger because of his red hair, a racial trait only found in persons of European ancestry. However, diggings also reveal a significant minority of Arabic peoples who were living in the Nile Delta Valley alongside the whites. And in the very far south, in what later became southern Egypt and the Sudan, lived a large number of blacks, known as Nubians. The existence of these two non-white groups within Egypt was to have a major impact on the history of that civilization. Their presence also destroys the environmental theory of the origin of civilizations, because all three groups shared the same environment, yet produced very different levels of achievement. In terms of contemporary timeframes, The Egyptian state first formally emerged shortly after the establishment of the civilization between the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley. By the year 3100 BC, a measure of unity had started to take hold in Egypt, coalescing into northern and southern kingdoms. Around that year, a dynamic leader named Menes united these northern and southern kingdoms and established a capital city at Memphis on the Nile River. The year 3100 BC therefore marks the start of the dynastic period, called the Old Kingdom by historians. Menes developed the idea of using channels to divert the waters of the Nile to irrigate land, and this irrigation system exists along the Nile River to this day. Menes was such a gifted and charismatic leader that he was deified by later Egyptians, and a cult developed which pictured him as a direct descendant of the gods, a tradition which then spread to other pharaohs. It is very likely that the word man originated with Menes. During his reign, construction was started on the greatest city of ancient Egypt, Memphis, which became the capital of this first kingdom. Also, about this time, Egyptian pictograph writing appeared, probably inspired by the Sumerian script. The Old Kingdom traded extensively with surrounding lands, obtaining wood from Lebanon and copper from mines in the Sinai Peninsula. It was also during this Old Kingdom period that the Great Pyramids and the Sphinx at Gaza were built, starting around the year 2500 BC. The project was launched by Pharaoh Cheops, also known as Khufu, who, because of the pyramids, remains one of the most famous pharaohs of this first kingdom. His daughter, Queen Hetopheres II of the 4th dynasty, is shown in a coloured bas-relief in a tomb to have been a distinct blonde. Her hair is painted a bright yellow, stippled with little red horizontal lines, and her skin is white. And that's a reference from The Races of Europe by Carlton Stevens Kuhn. The Cheops pyramids are not the oldest Egyptian pyramids. The Step Pyramid at Memphis predates them by at least a century, and was designed by a court architect, Imhotep. This great structure, nearly 216 feet or 66 meters high, must have seemed overwhelming to ordinary Egyptians at the time, who at best lived in two-story mud brick houses, and it is no surprise that the architect was eventually deified. The Cheops pyramids are impressive today, and by the standards of the time, they must have appeared to be a superhuman achievement. 20 years in the building, these pyramids used between 5 and 6 million tons of stone, some blocks being moved over 500 miles with almost perfect masonry work on site, so that the alignment variance of the stones, even today, is less than 1%. The greatest pyramid reaches 479 feet, or 146 meters, which is higher than St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, which remains the biggest cathedral in the world. Charms and magical prayers were collected into a book known as the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Many Egyptians ensured that these books were put into their tombs to assist in a successful resurrection. The focus of Egyptian religion was primarily concerned with the achievement of life after death. The practice of mummification was started on the basis of a myth that the god of the Nile River, Osiris, had been murdered by his evil brother Set. According to the myth, Set cut Osiris's body into pieces. These pieces were gathered together by Osiris's grieving widow Isis and reassembled, thus resurrecting him. The Nile god then became the first mummy, and every mummified Egyptian became a second Osiris. This resurrection theme was to be paralleled in Christianity as well. Thus, the tradition of mummification started, a jumpstart to everlasting life in the hereafter. The process of mummification has also provided present-day historians with a spectacular and unique chance to see the physical characteristics of Egyptians exactly as they were. The evidence is overwhelming that these first Egyptian societies were white, a proto-Nordic Alpine Mediterranean mixture. The leadership elite, in particular the pharaohs themselves, were mostly Nordic. the mummified remains of numerous pharaohs and common folk from this first great Egyptian civilization have unmistakable white features. For example, the well-preserved body of Pharaoh Ramses II has red hair, and there are large numbers of mummies whose blonde hair has been extraordinarily well-preserved through the centuries. This tradition of Nordic pharaohs was to last almost until the second part of the Third Kingdom, circa 1050 BC, by which time racial demographic shifts had taken place in Egyptian society in favour of non-white groups. All this is not to say that no other races lived in the area. There were a significant number of Arabic racial types who had settled there from their homeland in the Arabian Peninsula. These non-white peoples were, however, for many years, centuries even, excluded from mainstream Egyptian society because of their race. They were most often used as labourers, along with blacks captured by the Egyptians in warring expeditions even further south into present-day Sudan. Their numbers steadily increased during their stay in Egypt, and they became a significant demographic element in that land. Aside from the stupendous achievement of building the pyramids, the white civilization of Egypt is credited with many other advances, some of which benefit civilization to this day. The Egyptians were the first to divide the solar year into 365 and one quarter days, based on a 12-month cycle. The Egyptians also became famous for their medical skills, although the difference between magic and science does not appear to have been fully made. Evidence exists of advanced surgery having been carried out as far back as the First Kingdom, and many techniques and herbal remedies were taken over by the classical Greeks and survived right into medieval European times. In contrast to Mesopotamian writing, Egyptian writing, hieroglyphics, meaning sacred signs, remained pictorial in content throughout the span of this civilization. Egyptian writing was only deciphered in 1822, after the discovery of the Rosetta Stone. The period 2270 to 2060 BC was marked by great instability in Egypt, when the unity of the country fell to pieces. Only in the year 2060 BC was Egypt again politically united. It managed to attain a part of its old kingdom splendour, although it never built anything the size of the Great Pyramids of Giza again. This period of political unity did not last longer than 70 years, and around the year 1785 BC, a divided Egypt was conquered by a Canaanite tribe known as the Hyksos. And I'll just point out here that there were actually two invasions of the Hyksos. There was an earlier invasion of the Hyksos, and these Hyksos, or shepherd kings, were highly advanced. They're actually credited with building the Great Pyramid and also with building great cities there. And they were far in advance of the actual white Egyptians that were there. And then later on, we get a second invasion of Arabic peoples, but they were also called Hyksos, because Hyksos was the word for foreign invaders. It was Hyksos. Although it meant shepherd kings, they used the same term for this second lot of invaders, as I say, who were Arabic tribes, Canaanite tribes. They had little trouble subjecting the Egyptians, aided through the use of iron weapons and the horse and chariot, neither of which the Egyptians had seen before. The Hyksos had been attacked with this weapon by the Indo-European tribes who had developed the chariot on their route south from their respective homelands in the north, that's in the Caucasus. It took some 200 years for the Egyptians to rebuild their strength, and the Hyksos were finally expelled in 1580 BC, after the Egyptians had mastered the new weapon of horse and chariot and turned it against them. The Egyptian records show that the Minoans from Crete had helped fight the Hyksos invaders, further evidence of the close links between the Egyptians and the old European civilization. And I'll just point out here as well the fact that it was these Hyksos that had the wheeled chariots. That also gives you a hint as to who it was that was the pharaoh in charge of Joseph. When Joseph was in Egypt, it was obviously an Egyptian pharaoh, and then 400 years later, the pharaoh that knew not Joseph was obviously a Hyksos pharaoh. And you will recall, Pharaoh was in his chariots and the chariots got dashed to pieces in the sea. The result of 200 years of Hyksos rule had left its mark upon the Egyptian population. As reflected in its art, the white population after this time began to show increasing signs of non-white admixture. This Arabic mix came to characterize virtually the entire Middle East. However, an important element of the Egyptian population was by this time showing clear non-white ancestry. It was with the Third Kingdom and its expansion into areas heavily populated by Nubians, blacks from Sudan, and Ethiopia, occupied by Arab peoples, that large numbers of these non-whites came to be prominent in Egyptian society, either as slaves or freemen. I will point out that in Ethiopia at this time, they were still actually white. There's a record by Diodorus Siculus in about 50 BC that makes it clear that there are still white people in Ethiopia, although there probably were mixed types there as well. And the Bible makes reference to the Ethiopian having his skin having changed colour and he couldn't change it back to white again. And that was in the time of Jeremiah. So that was probably about 500, 600 BC, something like that. And what we are talking about here is 1500 BC. So I would suggest that the Ethiopians were still white at that time. And the mixing was with the Nubians, the blacks, which of course, if you are white and you mix with blacks, then that's going to turn you into an Arab. That's what an Arab is. The third and last great surge in Egyptian power came with the expulsions of the Hyksos. Adopting the horse and chariot, energetic and expansionist pharaohs set about consolidating Egypt and establishing an empire, Syria, Phoenicia, Palestine, Nubia, and northern Sudan, the latter with large black populations, were all conquered and incorporated into the Egyptian Empire. The greatest expansionist king was Thutmose III, circa 1501 BC to 1447. A series of tall pointed stone columns called obelisks were built to commemorate his various campaigns. Only four of the obelisks survived the strife of Egypt's history, and today they stand in Istanbul, Rome, London, and New York, silent reminders of the greatness of a bygone age. The greatest pharaoh of this time was Amenhotep III, 1411 to 1375 BC, who developed Thebes into the most magnificent city of the age. Amenhotep built many other huge structures, including the Temple of Luxor at the city of Thebes. Tutankhamun, the boy king, who died when he was 18, reigned around 1350 BC. Although he died too young to become a pharaoh of any great significance in his own time, he gained fame when his tomb was discovered intact in 1924, one of the few tombs to be found in such a good state. Most had been the subject of grave robbers centuries before. The gold burial mask of Tutankhamun has come to symbolize ancient Egypt. However, the real significance of the artifacts in the tomb has been largely ignored. Among Tutankhamun's possessions were some of the most graphic racial images in Egyptology. One of Tutankhamun's thrones, the ecclesiastical chair, has on its footrest the nine bows, the Egyptian name for the traditional enemies of Egypt. The finely crafted figures on the footrest are of nine blacks and Arabs tied together in chains. They were positioned on the footrest so that when the pharaoh sat on his throne, his enemies would be under his feet. Another graphically racial image found in Tutankhamun's tomb is found on one of his walking sticks. The handle is made up of what looks like a bound Jew and a bound black. When the Egyptian king went for a walk with his royal walking stick, he held the enemies of Egypt in his hand. And these figures that look like Jews, they're Canaanites. That's where the Jewish nose come from. That's where the Jews come from. Yet another candid racial image from Tutankhamun's tomb is found in a pair of sandals. inlaid with a picture of what looks like a Jew and a black, the pharaoh would trample his enemies underfoot when he walked. Tutankhamun's famous wooden chest, which was found in the antechamber of his tomb, contains yet another striking scene. On its sides, it shows the Egyptian king riding a chariot and trampling the enemies of Egypt, blacks and Canaanites. By Tutankhamun's time, then, the Egyptians were clearly aware of the growing numbers of their racial enemies creeping up on them. These graphic references to Egypt's racial enemies are ominous when it is considered that by the time of Tutankhamun, non-white slaves had already become commonplace. In addition to this, a significant number of Egyptians were now of mixed race. The Hyksos occupation, having left behind a number of Egyptian Arab Semitic types. Significantly, Tutankhamun's widow attempted to strike an alliance with the Indo-European Hittites, who had, in the interim, become the leading power in the Middle East by arranging her own marriage to a Hittite prince. The marriage never took place, as the husband-to-be was killed just prior to the ceremony. And the Hittites, they were a Canaanite tribe as well. There's a lot of confusion because you've got areas which are classed as, oh, this is a Hittite area. But it wasn't just always full of Hittites. It had Canaanite tribes in it at some periods and had white people in it at other periods. So there's confusion where people think the Hittites were white and the Hittites weren't white because they were the sons and daughters of Heth, who was a Canaanite. So when people think these Hittite tribes were actually white, what they're talking about is Indo-Europeans in the land that was originally belonging to the Hittites. And these peoples moved from, at various times, they moved around the area. So sometimes you had a non-white population and other times you had a white population. And this is why there's confusion here, because this author calls them Semitic types. But the actual definition of the Semitic type didn't really come about until 200 years ago. And you didn't actually have Jews at this time. Jews as a people didn't exist until about 500 BC, when the remnant of the tribe of Judah came back from Babylon and inhabited Jerusalem. And that's when they were first called Jews. And it was at that point that they interbred with the Canaanites. And before that, you had these Canaanite tribes who had the Jewish characteristics. They had that Jewish nose. You can see it in the in the depictions of the Hittites. And also you can see it in the depictions of the enemies of the Egyptians. And yet the tribes of Israel weren't enemies of the Egyptians. You don't even hear about Egypt after the Exodus, which is when all this is happening. You don't even hear about any fights with Egypt. So it's quite clear that the Egyptians were warring against these Canaanite peoples, not the tribes of Israel. From the time of Tutankhamun onwards, the final decline of Egypt was irreversible. Later kings tried to reverse the trend, and they sometimes succeeded temporarily in rolling back the waves of conquest and counter-conquest in Palestine and Syria. One pharaoh even managed to take a Hittite princess as a bride. See, and that shows to me that even the pharaoh was interbreeding with non-whites. But there were fresh enemies. Egypt was now attacked by new Indo-European invaders emerging from the Aegean, the so-called Sea People. As their name implied, they arrived by boat and raided Egyptian settlements, leaving again by the means that they had arrived. Now, these Sea Peoples, some of them were white and some of them were non-white. Once again, there's a confusion. These Sea Peoples were mainly comprised of Philistines from Asia Minor and Aegeans from mainland Greece. Egyptian illustrations of the time show prisoners with light hair and light eyes. Sea people raiders, unfortunately enough to fall into captivity in Egypt, could expect no mercy. Ever since the time of the Hyksos invasion and the fall of the Second Kingdom, the demographic shift among the Egyptian population had been against the original whites. Slowly but surely, non-whites, or mixed racial types, began to make up more and more of that country's population, drawn in as slaves, labourers, immigrants, or invaders. These other racial types were of two sorts. The modern Semite, or Arab, who the Egyptians called sand dwellers, and blacks from the region of Nubia in the far south, present-day Sudan. A review of Egypt's relations with Nubia is therefore crucial to understanding what happened to the white Egyptians and why they vanished. Clashes between the Egyptians and the black Nubians had long been a feature of Egyptian history, with the first campaigns against the Nubians launched by Old Kingdom pharaohs around 2900 BC. In 2570 BC, Pharaoh Sneferu launched a concerted attack upon Nubia. Egyptian records show that 70,000 prisoners were taken. In 1296 BC, Egypt conquered Nubia and built a series of massive forts to protect its southern borders against the Nubians, with the most famous of these being the fort at Buhen, which had walls which were over 364 feet high and almost 15 foot thick. Along the banks of the southern Nile, huge stones were erected, upon which, in hieroglyphics still visible today, the passage of blacks past these points was forbidden. It was the first public, whites-only sign in history. At the time of the Hyksos invasion of Egypt, many local Nubian kings allied themselves with the Hyksos and inflicted defeats upon the weakened Egyptians, including the destruction of the southern forts. When the Hyksos were finally driven out, the white Egyptians exacted a terrible revenge upon the blacks, launching many campaigns of conquest and suppression against them, all the while bringing back thousands into Egypt as slaves, a racial time bomb which was to eventually destroy Egyptian civilization. The white Egyptians left many references to the black population in Nubia and in their own country. In fact, at one point, their writings record a law that forbade blacks from entering their country at all. An overview of these written inscriptions is highly worthwhile and devastates claims by pro-black historians who, in an attempt to distort the historical record, claim that the ancient Egyptian civilization was black in racial origin. The most complete record and translation of these scripts was undertaken by Professor James Henry Breasted, Professor of Egyptology and Oriental History in the University of Chicago, in his work, History of Egypt, From the Earliest Times to the Persian Conquest, 2nd edition, 1909. An inscription that was written by Count Uni, Governor of the South and an official of the Old Kingdom, reads as follows. His Majesty made war on the Asiatic sand dwellers, and His Majesty made an army of many 10,000s, in the entire south, among the Erthet blacks, the Maasai blacks, the Yam blacks, among the Wawa blacks, among the Kau blacks, and in the land of Time. This is an example of the Old Kingdom, 2980-2475 BC, Pharaoh, using thousands of blacks as mercenaries. The army was sent into southern Palestine, and returned in safety after it had hacked up the land of the sand dwellers. His Majesty sent me to dig 5 canals in the south, and to make 3 cargo boats and 4 rowboats of acacia wood of Wawat. Then the black chiefs of Erthet, Wawai, Yam, and Maasai drew timber, therefore, and I did the whole in only 1 year. The Pharaoh came to expect this work, and at the coming of the king himself, standing behind the hill country, while the chiefs of Maasai, Erthet, and Wawat did obeisance and gave great praise. This writing shows very clearly the use of blacks as labour, and illustrates how they were slowly but surely drawn into Egyptian society. It also proves that these Canaanites were Arabs, because that's who was inhabiting Palestine at the time of 2980 BC to 2475 BC. The final conquest of Nubia was attained by Sesostris III, in 1840 BC, this king conducted 4 campaigns against the blacks and erected several forts at strategic points, making Nubia a permanent colony of Egypt. The first Semneh Stelae inscription, recounting the subjugation of Nubia by Sesostris III, reads as follows. Southern boundary made in the year 8 under the majesty of the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Sesostris III, in order to prevent that any black should cross it, by water or by land, with a ship, or any herds of the blacks, except a black who shall come to do trading in Iken, or with a commission. Every good thing shall be done with them, but without allowing a ship of the blacks to pass by He, going downstream, forever. The inscription of Amose reads, Now, after his majesty had slain the Asiatics, he ascended the river to destroy the Nubian troglodytes. His majesty made a great slaughter among them. The Tumos stele of Thutmosis I reads, He hath overthrown the chief of the Nubians. The black is helpless, defenceless in his grasp. He hath united the boundaries of his two sides. There is not a remnant among the curly-haired who came to attack. There is not a single survivor among them. They fall by the sword. The fragments cut from them are too much for the birds. In the annals of the great warrior king Thutmose III, at the sixth Karnak pylon, there is a list that contains no less than 115 of the names of the towns and districts of the conquered Nubian regions. Another pylon at Karnak contains references to about 400 towns, districts, and countries conquered in Nubia. Inscribed on one of the tablets is the famous Hymn of Victory, which reads as follows. I have bound together the Nubian troglodytes by the tens of thousands, the northerners by hundreds of thousands, as prisoners. Another remarkable inscription is to be found on the Semne stele of Amenhotep III, which is also in the British Museum in London. It reads as follows. List of the captivity, which his majesty took in the land of Ibet the Wretched. List of prisoners and killed. Living blacks, 150 heads. Archers, 110 heads. Female blacks, 250 heads. Servants of the blacks, 55 heads. Their children, 175 heads. Total, 740 heads. Hands thereof, 312. United with the living heads, 1,052. The true Egyptians had all vanished at the very latest by 800 BC, and the divided and weakened Egypt was easy prey for numerous invaders, some Arabic, some Nubian, and some Indo-European, but none of whom established any sort of permanent rule. The Nubian invaders set up a new kingdom known as the 25th Dynasty, 746 to 655, and claimed to be the inheritors of the previous kingdoms. This 100-year dynasty saw a number of Nubian and mixed-race rulers, all claiming to be pharaohs and attempting to revive some of the older practices, such as mummification. These non-white Egyptians were an illusion. The true white Egyptians had vanished, along with their society, and the Nubian dynasty sputtered out of its own accord. The last pharaoh of this Nubian dynasty, Taharqa, whose mixed-race ancestry is clear from sculptures, was driven from his throne by invading Assyrians, and it is from this fall of Taharqa that historians formally date the fall of Egypt, although in reality, the last true Egyptian had disappeared nearly 200 years previous. The course of racial developments in Egyptian history has been backed up by anthropological research. The British anthropologist G. M. Morant produced a comprehensive study of Egyptian skulls from commoner and royal graves from all parts of the Egyptian lands and times. His conclusions were that the majority of the population of Lower Egypt, that is, in the northern part of the country, were members of the Mediterranean white subrace. In the south, or Upper Egypt, this population pattern was repeated, but this time showed a certain percentage of black admixture, reflecting the proximity of the Nubian settlement. Significantly, Morant found that with the passage of time, the differentiation in skull types between Upper and Lower Egypt became less and less distinct, until ultimately they became indistinguishable, the surest sign of the absorption of the white race into the growing non-white mass. After passing under Ethiopian, Assyrian, and Persian rule, Egypt was finally occupied in 325 BC by the Greek Macedonian Alexander the Great, whose tribe was one of the original Indo-European invaders of the Greek peninsula. The famous Queen Cleopatra, often associated with ancient Egypt, was one of these ruling Macedonians and not an Egyptian. Under Cleopatra's rule, Egypt became a Roman outpost. Although the Macedonians adopted certain cultural characteristics of ancient Egypt, the true Egyptians had long since passed from the world stage, absorbed into the mixed-race mass of the Middle East. Okay, that finishes with Egypt. Tomorrow, we are going to look at America. Thank you very much for listening. God bless and hail victory. We'll be right back.